Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Brooke Hardy, attorney registration number 45044, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Montoya. Denver Public Schools, or DPS, policies GDQD and GDQDR provide a mandatory termination procedure before a classified employee is dismissed. And policy GDI, which contains no at-will disclaimer, states that a classified employee shall have continued service during efficient performance of duties and good behavior, modeling the classic civil service language requiring just cause. In Ms. Montoya's complaint, she pled facts that create an inference that an implied contract existed between Ms. Montoya and DPS, and the district court erred when it dismissed her breach of contract claim and didn't allow a jury, the trier of fact, to determine whether a contract existed. An at-will employee in the state of Colorado has no right to contest their employment in a court of law, including their termination. There is ample Colorado case law, including Keenan, Court, Kronk, and DeRubis, that states that once an employer provides mandatory termination procedures, they become contractually bound to those, and an employee can bring a lawsuit for the violation of these policies.
Why is this case couched in implied contract?
It's an implied contract because the contract is based on the district's policies themselves rather than a written employment contract.
So you're not saying implied contract is something that may or may not be entered into in this instance. You're saying that based upon GDQ, based on the original statement of the employee status, which is oddly called a tenure rule, that a contract exists?
Correct, Your Honor.
Without any further inquiry?
Well, and the inquiry goes into a couple things. First of all, whether or not the employer produced these policies, which they did. Also, whether an employee worked for the employer, which would be considered consideration, and also whether or not the employee relied on these policies, which Ms. Montoya did do in this case when she invoked her termination procedure rights under policy GDQDR. DPS's policy GDI, as you had mentioned, is titled Support Staff Probation, Tenure, and Seniority. It states that a classified employee who is employed continuously for 2 years and is beginning their third year becomes a continued employee, and that they shall only be dismissed for bad behavior, inefficient performance of their duties. And again, as you said, this policy itself is entitled tenure, meaning that a classified employee who has worked for DPS for 3 or more years continuously can only be discharged for cause.
Ms. Pardee, it seems like you're omitting reference to the last part of that sentence from the policy, or the policy GDI. It says the employee shall have continuing service as a classified employee during efficient performance of duties, good behavior, and continuous service without the need for recurring annual appointment.
Correct.
But isn't that simply about whether annual reappointments are necessary?
Well, whether or not they receive annual appointment letters or not, they still are continued employees. The mere fact that they're not going to be given a letter every year doesn't change the analysis. I mean, the policy specifically says you'll have continuous employment as long as you efficiently perform your duties and good behavior. Again, it's really making a distinction without a difference whether or not they get this letter that you would typically get in your first 2 years.
Well, then what about policy GDQD, which says continuing service classified employees may be dismissed for any lawful reason?
Right, and so the argument made by DPS is that this is a valid disclaimer in order to disclaim any intent to enter into a contract. First of all, GDI, which has the cause dismissal, doesn't have this disclaimer. Secondly, even if there is a disclaimer, an employer may nevertheless been found to have an intent to be bound by that if they contain mandatory termination procedures or require cause for termination. As discussed, I believe one of the cases that discussed it was the Evanson case. Furthermore, the disclaimers in these policies are not clear, as they're contradicted by not only that same policy providing mandatory termination procedures, but they're also contradicted by policy GDI.
So just to make sure I understand your argument, you're saying because at the very least there's a contradiction, in some of these policies, that creates an ambiguity, which is an issue for a jury?
Correct. It's up to the jury to determine whether or not a contract in fact existed. And like I said, the mere fact that there is a disclaimer doesn't preclude the finding that an implied contract between an employer and employee does exist.
Thank you.
But assuming you're correct that she has some form of tenure or some form of continuous employment, which in my understanding of the law becomes a property right, which may or may not be able to terminate without due process. Is there anything wrong with the due process here? It seems to me that the school district followed its termination policy.
When Ms. Montoya was being terminated, she did invoke the ability to have the two hearings that are provided to her. However, the policy requires, the termination procedures require, a neutral hearing officer to determine whether the grounds for the dismissal are present. Now,
it also provides that's not binding on the employer, does it not?
That is correct. However, the DPS in their own policy states that the purpose of the procedures is to treat employees fairly and equitably. They allow for this hearing officer to make a determination as to whether these grounds were present. Now, in this case, it was insubordination. The hearing officer found that that wasn't present. And so by still terminating her employment, they violated the policy of treating these employees fair and equitably. In addition, just because the decision is not binding on the district, it doesn't relieve DPS from terminating a continuing service classified employee without grounds and without cause.
Well, I thought the administrator found that there were grounds. Concluded there were grounds, insubordination being one.
I believe there was a number of allegations that led to an overall grounds of insubordination in its entirety, and the hearing officer determined that that wasn't present, that she had not been insubordinate, and that the charges, or the dismissal charges, quote unquote, brought against Ms. Montoya were arbitrary and capricious, which would violate their own policy to treat employees fair and equitably.
But the superintendent, or his or her designee, found otherwise.
He found otherwise based on information that he or she had received from their own employees, not necessarily based on what had been discussed, the evidence presented, and arguments presented in the hearing in front of the neutral hearing officer.
But given that the superintendent's decision is the operative one, the binding one, shouldn't that decision be more interesting and more relevant to us?
No, the reason why I would say that it's not is, for example, in teacher cases, they have the same rights. They have it right in front of the neutral hearing officer. It's still the Board of Education's final decision. However, that doesn't mean that they can terminate them arbitrarily and capriciously. There are restrictions on that when it comes to teachers, and DPS has promulgated policies that have the same restrictions for classified employees. The superintendent didn't base this on actual information, rather based it on employee supervisors who the hearing officer ultimately found were acting arbitrarily and capriciously for even bringing this dismissal against Ms. Montoya.
Did I
answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
So you're suggesting that the ability of the administration of the school district to disregard the findings of the independent hearing officer denies due process?
Yes. The purpose of due process is to be sure that before a person is, before their rights are taken from them, that they have an opportunity to present their evidence and their arguments and such.
But you've not made a due process argument.
Well, the due process argument would be the procedural due process argument, the argument that these policies required them to go through this process and that it was that DPS violated it by arbitrarily and capriciously still terminating her employment, even though a hearing officer found that none of the grounds for her termination were in fact present.
But you haven't explicitly alleged a constitutional violation in this court anyway. I'm not sure if you did below, but you certainly have not in your briefs in this court.
Right, and the argument in this case is basically a breach of contract.
So it's not a constitutional claim you're raising.
The contract gave her procedures and due process before she could be terminated. And so, therefore, we're grounding the argument in those policies rather than the broader scope of the Constitution.
So you're not raising a constitutional argument, correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
You're also arguing that somehow the standard for dismissal of professional employees who are classified, which as I recall, just cause, applies to your client.
Correct. I would argue that the policies create a just cause requirement to terminate classified employees.
That's not in the termination process for classified employees, is it?
If the words just cause?
Right.
No, the words just cause are not in the procedure itself. However, there
what is the difference between cause and just cause?
I would say that they're one of the same. They require that there be a reason, a legitimate reason for the dismissal that is in violation of policies or insubordination or other things such as that. Using the word just cause, it is making a distinction without a difference.
Ms. Pardee, what is the effect in one or maybe two of the policies that says that the procedures do not change the at-will status of the employee?
What is the effect of it? I would argue that because it's not clear and because it's contradicted by other things in the policy and other policies promulgated by DPS, that it is not a clear disclaimer and that it doesn't prevent the determination that as a classified employee, just cause was required and that the employees are no longer at will.
Well, I think some of our cases have drawn the distinction between disclaimers, as you mentioned, that are clear and ones that aren't clear. So is that a legal question to determine whether a disclaimer is clear, or is your view that as long as there are apparently conflicting statements, then it becomes a jury question?
I believe there's conflicting statements, then it becomes a jury question for them to determine whether or not there was an implied contract and what the what the contract consisted of.
But do you agree with what my first statement was, is the courts have drawn a distinction between disclaimers that are clear and ones that might not be clear?
They have drawn a distinction between that, yes. There's also been cases that have ruled that even with a disclaimer that it can arguably be clear, or procedures that are not required with a disclaimer, that it's still a determination for the jury. It still creates the inference that although there's this disclaimer, that's not, the employee's status was not at will, and in fact had an expectation of continued employment unless they were dismissed for cause.
So when is it when there are apparently conflicting statements, when is it appropriate for the jury to decide that, as opposed to when it's appropriate for a court to determine whether a disclaimer is clear?
So based on the case law, a court should rule that, for example, that there's no implied contract when there's no conflicting inferences. For example, if there was the termination procedure said, we may give this procedure to some employees, we may not, and has a disclaimer, courts there have found that there is no implied contract. However, when you have a disclaimer and mandatory procedures, that it should be a question for the jury to decide.
Are you asking us to decide under the, what I will call a tenure policy, that Ms. Montoya was not an employee at will as a matter of law?
Correct, Your Honor. Or at least that there's an inference that she wasn't an at-will employee under the law, and that a jury should have made that determination. And this time I would like to reserve the rest of my time for any further argument.
You may.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. On behalf of Denver Public Schools, Matt Ratterman, number 32652.
This case is substantially the same as one which was ruled upon by Judge Mache, affirmed by the Tenth Circuit, and then Judge Eliff in the Denver District Court followed the precedent. It actually boils down very, very simply to not just a question of whether there was a contract, but whether that contract was for just cause, or imposed a just cause standard to terminations of continuing service classified employees.
Is there a difference between cause and just cause?
I think there is probably a bit of a distinction, just cause being a term of art that is through case law been refined into 12 or 14 points. That's not really at issue here in terms of which of the elements of just cause would be in play, because just cause simply is not in play at all.
Well, if you have employment at will, can't you just walk up to the employee and say you're fired and they're fired?
You certainly can.
And you don't have to give them a reason?
That is correct.
And they don't have any rights to a hearing?
Unless provided otherwise through their...
So why does the school district adopt a policy which on its face appears to grant something akin to tenure, and then provide a rather extended due process procedure for terminating classified employees?
Well, I think it's important to compare what is available to continuing service classified employees and what is more traditionally called tenure, or now non-probationary.
Tenure is not my word. Tenure is the policy's word.
Okay, well, the rights that are afforded teachers, for example, tenured teachers, are far different, and are the procedures are different than they are in this.
Well, they're statutorily mandated.
They are.
Okay. And this is a wholly different environment, I appreciate. But I assume that this policy was adopted by the school board.
It was. And I think the purpose of it was to add a layer of fair, equitable treatment, an opportunity to be heard, an opportunity for the employee to present his or her side of the dispute.
Which is arguably eyewash, correct?
Arguably eyewash?
Eyewash. I mean, it's just to make people feel comfortable. Because it has no substance, because the school district's not bound by it.
Well, the school district is not bound by it, and that's the procedure that the board decided to allow its employees. That isn't to say that it's eyewash. That isn't to say that the district disregards any contrary finding. In this situation, there certainly were reasons why it did. And in fact, the arbitrator's recommendations and finding did not track the process identified in GDQDR. The arbitrator recommended reversal of the dismissal recommendation. He was without authority to do that once he made factual findings that were consistent with the recommendation to dismiss. And I'll refer you to page 55 of the record, which shows what the recommendations were, what the grounds were. There were six grounds. And the arbitrator improperly limited his analysis to one ground, that being insubordination. The other five grounds were not addressed at all in terms of being the grounds for dismissal. As such, and he made findings in his findings and recommendation that were consistent and that bore out the dismissal recommendation, specifically that the employee did not complete an accurate count of what she was supposed to count, that she lied to an investigator, and she did not follow security procedures. Finding any one of those precluded the hearing officer from recommending retention of the employee. So you can say it's eyewash. I think.
No, I'm not saying those are eyewash. I'm saying the policy is eyewash.
Well, the policy retains a safeguard, or the right of the district to consider the impartial hearing officer's recommendations, but not be bound by it. And that's exactly what happened here. The policy, as has been discussed, the policies, let's talk a little bit about GDI. And I think Judge Navarro's question was on point. GDI does not grant tenure does not grant the right to continued employment without, or a property right in continued employment. What it does create is a status whereby DPS does not need to send an annual letter. And you can see in GDQD, which refers to the termination procedure for continuing service classified employees, that they are at will, even though they are called continuing service classified employees. Nothing in the procedures changed the at-will status of continuing service classified employees. It couldn't be clearer than that.
Well, counsel, what seems to me a little bit less clear is if DPS is treating these employees as purely at will, why does the district constrain its authority to following these procedures? Isn't that inconsistent with how you treat an at-will employee?
It's consistent with its minimum obligations. DPS has chosen to add an additional opportunity for an employee to be heard.
And exactly, doesn't that transform the employee to something more than at-will?
No, it does not. But what it does transform the employee to is an at-will employee who has the right to two hearings. And the second hearing is in front of someone who can make a recommendation that the district is not required to follow. So it provides an additional opportunity, a second chance for some, but it certainly does not restrict any rights, take away anything that an at-will employee would not have anyway.
You would agree that if you wanted to make it clear that they were at-will employees, that language would appear in GDI.
I'm not sure that it's necessary there. The case law that has talked about when you can imply a contract speaks specifically about the clear and conspicuous language appearing in the dismissal or the termination procedures. And they do appear there in both GDQD and GDQDR. As the court noted correctly, GDI does not discuss dismissal at all. It doesn't discuss just cause at all. Those appear only in GDQD and GDQDR, both of which are clear and conspicuous in disclaiming an implied contract or a contract of any kind, and certainly for just cause. Let's talk about just cause a little bit. There is discussion of just cause in both GDQD and GDQDR, but those policies are not just for continuing service classified employees. They are also for licensed non-teaching employees, such as social workers, counselors, psychologists. Terminations of those employees are also subject to GDQD and GDQDR, and the just cause language appears for those. So licensed non-teaching employees do have a higher standard or additional rights that continuing service classified employees, such as Ms. Montoya, did not. So there's no basis to imply or to impose just cause when a different standard is articulated in the policy, and that standard is whether evidence for the grounds is present. And the hearing officer found explicitly that evidence for the grounds was found in the
And you're saying that's the standard less than cause?
I believe it is, yes.
Mr. Ratterman, I'd like to follow up on your discussion of the impartial hearing officer's grounds for termination. You said that five of his six findings would have supported termination. And it sounds from what you're saying is that even if we were to decide that Ms. Montoya was not an at-will employee, that there were nevertheless sufficient grounds for her termination.
There certainly were.
Is that correct?
Let me clarify what I said. I didn't say that five of the six were in favor of the district's recommendation. Three of them were not addressed at all. The first two having to do with following security procedures and doing the job she was assigned to do, making an accurate count of the coats. The impartial hearing officer found explicitly she had not done, or that she had, that the district's grounds were found. At that point, under the GDQD R, the the arbitrator was powerless, had no authority to recommend reversal of the dismissal recommendation. But he went past his authority there and limited his discussion, saying that the dismissal ground was insubordination. He used singular ground, which was only one of the six grounds that the district provided to.
Right. So as I understand what you're saying, even if we were to assume that the hearing officer were correct about his finding on insubordination, that he was without authority to conclude otherwise based on these other two findings, and is that correct?
Yeah, that is, and reminds me that I didn't answer your question.
If that's so, then it sounds like we might be able to decide this case without deciding whether Ms. Montoya was in fact an at-will employee.
Well, I think you certainly can. The grounds were present for that. She was at will. I believe that the disclaimers are effective. They were clear. They were conspicuous. That issue was never raised on appeal, and it was found explicitly both by the Tenth Circuit and by the trial court. But if she were not at will, she still would have been dismissed according to GDQDR because the grounds existed.
Mr. Raderman, what is your definition of an at-will employee?
At-will employee is an employee hired for an unspecified period of time with no contractual obligations or limitations on the ability of the employer to discharge that employee.
Okay, well, following up on that, could the district have fired Ms. Montoya without complying with the dismissal procedures in the policy?
No, I believe it could not have.
Going back to your definition of at-will employee, she's not one then, because there is a restraint on the employer's ability to fire.
Well, maybe I should supplement what I said in that an at-will employee also can be dismissed at any time for any legal reason. So I don't think that this actually alters the at-will status, allowing her the opportunity for two hearings. Even if it does, it was met here. There's no question that she received the full benefit of whatever a contract would have provided to her. But no, I think at its core, the district can dismiss an employee, an at-will employee, for any reason. And that, I think that explains or sheds a little light on the district's ultimate right to disregard the recommendation of the impartial hearing officer. Because if it were not an at-will employee, if that were a binding recommendation, then I think you could argue that that she was no longer at will.
Thank you.
The couple points that are important here. First, there was a little bit of discussion about what's fair and equitable treatment. And it's important to note that fair and equitable treatment is not an enforceable promise, and it certainly does not impose a just cause standard. It's also worthy of the little time I have left to look at what was not contested or appealed in this matter. There's been no discussion, no contention by the plaintiff that the disclaimer was not clear and conspicuous. There's been no argument that the arbitrator did in fact find grounds that were consistent with the DPS recommendation for termination. There's been no dispute that the hearing officer's recommendation is advisory only. And there's
I'm not quite sure I follow you. I thought I heard your opposing counsel dispute the notion that the disclaimer was clear. You're saying they conceded that it was clear?
They never raised it in their briefs, never once, never at the trial level and never now. And
earlier, by now I meant
the appeal.
Okay.
And the appeal briefing.
Are you saying that was the first time we've heard that?
That certainly is the first time we've heard that.
Okay, thank you.
And then finally, there's certainly been no argument that Ms. Montoya received the full benefit of what GDQD and GDQDR provide to her the opportunity for two hearings, the second being in front of an impartial hearing officer, which is advisory only. That's my time.
Thank you. Ms. Pardee, you have 52 seconds.
Don't waste it.
I'll make this real fast. One of the arguments was that we had conceded that the disclaimers were clear, and I would disagree with that. It wasn't inherent in our objection to the motion to dismiss by arguing that the disclaimers didn't prevent an implied contract from being formed, therefore that they weren't clear. And in addition, I want to talk about Jones real quick, just because he had touched on it. Jones is a 10th Circuit case, which isn't binding on this court. In addition, that court only determined that there was no implied contract based on GDQDR. Their analysis had no, there was no analysis on GDI, which is, again, the one that has grounds for dismissal and for tenure. In addition, GDI creates an expectation of continued employment once you've been working for DPS for 3 or more years, and it changes the employment status in and of itself. Go from a classified employee to a continuing classified employee. And that's my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.